Good afternoon, everyone. Hope you've had a nice day here at the conference. Welcome to Leveraging Technology, particularly Blended Learning, Distance Learning, and Mobile Learning. We're going to be covering those topics today, focusing on those. I'm Steve Kwan, Director of the EdTech Center here, not here, but at World Education. And I'd really like to welcome you today. It's exciting because 1 year ago, not today, but this month, we launched the EdTech Center at World Education, and we now have a banner, and this is our second panel. And we, 1 year ago, we started this month, and in a year, it's really been a dizzying year with many things that we've done over the year. We're really proud of what we've accomplished. Particularly with that, a lot of thanks go to folks like Leah Peterson, our assistant director, and Ebony Vandross, Ben Bruno, who works as instructional technologist, and then our ed tech partners, David Rosen and Jen Vanek. We had somewhere around 7 webinars with over 1,300 participants. We started the IDEAL Consortium, which was at one time the Project IDEAL, and had a summer institute this summer with 10 states, and we're aiming for more this coming year. We updated the handbook, the IDEAL handbook, to include blended learning, and our courses are now including that, and we're adding new multimedia courses on blended learning, OERs, and mobile learning. And we're happy to say that we've started this year now with 3 new projects, one of which is IDEAL. And we'll introduce Jen Vanek in a second, who's directing that. She'll be our moderator today. We wanted to have a panel that was wide-ranging. So we've included teachers and professional developers, authors and researchers, and folks from ESL, ABE, higher education, and K-12. So we want to hear from all perspectives on blended distance and mobile learning. So I'm going to introduce to you Jen Vanek, who is our director of IDEAL and is moderating the panel today. I'll give you a little, I'll look at my cheat sheet here. She's currently a doctoral student at University of Minnesota. She's been working in the field.
Go first.
She's been working in the field of adult literacy since receiving her master's in teaching, ESO, English as a Second Language, in 1995. Her recent work centers on online content for adult learners and supporting professional development of ESL and ABE teachers in the area of digital literacy. She also is the educational coordinator for North Star Digital Literacy Project, for those that know of that, and you'll hear more about that if you attend a workshop in the next couple of days. And has a great interest in distance and blended learning and adult career pathways. We will be having an opportunity for you to participate this year. Last year, I think we had 10 panelists, and this year we hope to have more participation and more time for participation in the audience. And so I will be going around with a mic at different spots. If you have something that you want to say, then you can raise your hand at that time. We'll let you know. But perhaps you want to just write something down in a question, and you're shy. And so if that's the case, feel free to write something down on a piece of paper and hand it to me, and I'll be happy to read that out. We are recording this, so make sure you don't say anything off color. And Jen, take it away.
Thanks. Welcome, everyone. And thanks to Steve and Celia and everyone else at WorldEd for inviting me to moderate this panel. And thanks to the panelists for joining in this discussion. I'm really looking forward to hearing some of the stuff you have to say. So to kick it off, I'd just like to give a 1 minute of context. So as you know, probably in 2010, 2011, we had just over 2 million adult learners enrolled in formal adult basic education in the U.S. That represents just a fraction of the 36 million adults who we suspect have limited skills enough to prevent them from matriculating into post-secondary institution or getting the job that they hope to get or entering into careers. So that often due to barriers, lack of resources, lack of perceived relevance, or the programming available in their geographic location. So that's happening at the same time where we have this intense technological ubiquity in our society, where in fact you're not able to matriculate into post-secondary ed without some digital literacy skills, without using those skills while you're doing adult basic ed, or even applying for an entry-level job. So these two things together present a tremendous challenge and tension for us as practitioners and program delivery administrators or researchers. And the good news is that the people on this panel have been spending some time and energy and investing some creativity to embrace technology to help resolve this tension. So I'm just going to give a brief introduction and bio, and then we'll turn it over to the panelists. So first we have Chris Bouret. Chris is the academic program specialist with the Rhode Island Family Literacy Initiative, which I only knew as Wi-Fi for a really long time, so it's great to see the acronym spelled out. Chris has taught for over 2 decades in higher ed and adult education programs and helped pilot the Words to Learn project, which developed an app that accelerates learning of academic and health career-related vocabulary for adults preparing to enter post-secondary ed and technical training. We also have David Rosen, who is a researcher and educational consultant with Newsom Associates. For many years, David was director of the Adult Literacy Resource Institute, sponsored by University of Massachusetts Boston, where he encouraged and provided professional development on integrating technology in the classroom. As an independent consultant, David now works on several projects, including moderating 2 links, communities of practice, one on program management and the other on technology and learning. So welcome to Chris and David. We also have Simona Simpson-Thomas, who's director of multiple pathways at Providence Public School System. Through work with the school, Simona's been primarily responsible for creating innovative policies and programs for personal learning initiatives in the district. This includes identifying ways to support student learning while embracing students' individual needs, promoting student agency while aligning and preparing for college and career readiness. So welcome, Simona. And finally, we have Joe Stubblefield, who is the Director of Educational Technology for the Arizona Department of Education, Adult Education Services. In this role, Joe provides leadership and strategic planning for initiatives and activities around technology integration, distance learning, and hybrid learning. He's currently working on a very big initiative to spread the use and increase the quality of hybrid or blended learning across all of Arizona's adult basic education system, every program, and is currently utilizing the EdTech Center Ideal Consortium professional development materials for that work. So today we're going to hear from each of these panelists about what they see, how they see distance, blended, and mobile learning as a response to the challenge or the tension I described previously, and really creating meaningful learning opportunities for the students working within their programs or schools as they try to transition into post-secondary work. So first, we're just going to hear from them for like 2 or 3 minutes. They'll showcase their work as it pertains to the theme of this round table, and then I'll get into some more focused questions. Several points along the way, I'll pause and we'll have questions from you in the audience and try to get a little bit of a dialogue going. So here's the first question, and we'll just do 2 minutes each, and you can kind of, whoever wants to jump in first, go ahead. So the first prompt is, when you think about the topic of the session, leveraging technology, specifically with respect to distance, blended, and mobile learning, What is it about your work that comes to mind? Go ahead, Chris.
Oh, okay. I'll go first. Hi, everyone. I guess for me, the biggest thing is the mobile learning aspect of that question. I think in the last 4 or 5 years, I and the other teachers in my organization have utilized mobile learning a lot in the classroom. Students come in without computers at home and maybe with emerging digital literacy skills, but they do have cell phones, and they're usually smartphones. More and more, I think you see students with smartphones. Even if they don't know how to use them, they have them in class. And the idea is getting them to use that in class. So many apps, learning management systems, sites, make use of cell phones, so it's easy to get students, for example, to record themselves, to record their voice, to film themselves, take pictures, things like that, but also to download a doc, to read something, to watch a YouTube video online. There's so many things you can do. Take a grammar quiz. There's so many different avenues you can have students do on that. And I've noticed once you're able to get students to do that, it really changes them. It changes me as a teacher. It changes how you teach away from paper and pencil into hey, let's play a quiz. Let's do, you know, and if you gave them a quiz, paper and pencil, let's take a quiz. Okay. But if it's suddenly it's like a gamification on an app, it's like, ooh, yeah, let's take a quiz. So it changes how they look at learning, and it changes what you do in the classroom. And but what I think that leads to, once you have them kind of captive to mobile learning, it leads to different avenues of distance and blended learning.
Great, thanks. Yeah. Joe, do you want to add?
Sure.
So the question is, what is it about, when you think about the theme, leveraging technology and distance blended and mobile, what about your work comes to mind?
I think the biggest part is leveraging technology to create those, you know, personalized learning experiences. So with us in Arizona, we're really focusing on hybrid learning and distance learning and implementing that. So getting the instructors to think differently and look at their roles differently as facilitators and guides, no longer sages on the stage. So that whole mind shift, as well as getting the learners to think differently. They're responsible for their learning. And us incorporating, you know, technology integration, those tools in the classroom, as well as online curriculum, is important in speeding up ways that students learn. Also, I think for me, the professional development piece, focusing on integrating technology in the classroom and helping teachers do that is important because they're using this technology to help students gain the skills they need to be college and career ready. And then as well as helping students create, investigate, connect, and learn via, you know, digital environments or in the digital classroom. So I see many different prongs when it comes to what we're doing and the trends and blended and distance and then also technology integration.
Great, thanks. How about David?
Thanks, Jen. I try to sometimes boil everything down into a simple formula, and it doesn't always work. But in this case, increasingly, I think about what I call the three C's. And these are comfort, competence, and confidence in using technology for learning. Using technology, period, but in our context, using technology for learning. And I'm talking about that for students, and I'm also talking about it for us, for teachers, administrators, professional developers, our whole field. Again, comfort, competence, and confidence, because these are really the, this is what transfers to being able to solve problems in technology that we face newly, in new environments, in new contexts, and with new levels of challenge and difficulty. Some of my interests for the past few years have focused on blended learning. A couple of years ago, I published a guide on blended learning in the adult education classroom. This is available free, by the way. You can download it or read it online. I actually recommend reading it online. I'm also interested, and have been for some time, in using mobile devices. Several years ago, I started an international Wigio group for adult educators who are interested in using mobile devices, obviously smartphones, but not only smartphones, tablets and others, and who knows, phablets. You know about phablets, the combination of phone and tablet? Some people actually have these now, not me yet. I'm also interested in, and I'm certainly not an expert in this, but this is what I hope to gain some expertise in over the next couple of years, and that is the whole issue of how to best help adult learners learn how to learn online. I think that's a central problem of our field that needs solving, and also, by the way, I might add, needs research. And then lastly, I'm very interested in and have a lot of excitement about the international assessment of adult skills, which is incidentally not an assessment of adult learners. It's an assessment of people in, I guess, something like over 20 countries now, of which we are one. These assessments are of literacy, numeracy, and something new called problem solving in technology-rich environments. And I'm particularly interested in this whole notion of problem solving. It's really about problem solving that happens to either require or benefit from the use of technology. So I throw those interests out because you may be interested in them, and I'd love to talk with you about that, or you may have some questions about that, and you'll have plenty of opportunity to ask those questions.
Thanks, David. Simona, can you introduce your thinking on the topic of the theme of the panel?
Yep. Hi, my name's Simona, and as said, I am the director of Multiple Pathways for Providence, but I like to still call myself a teacher at heart. I've always, as a teacher, had the opportunity to really understand the importance of personalizing experiences for students, especially those in urban environments where technology may not always be very accessible for them. So a part of how I see leveraging technology and thinking about that term is around equality, accessibility, and differentiation. So for me as a classroom teacher, it always has been difficult when you have some students on the higher end and you want to push them, and then you have some students that may need some extra support, and really having an opportunity to experience creating some online curriculum that's personalized for students. I've also had the experience of working with different platforms that allow for me to really differentiate and use formative assessments in a way that allow for students to have access on all spectrums. So part of the work that we're doing in the district is realizing that with the online tools and using those as a way to leverage where students are to assess what they need and really to personalize the instruction. I think an important piece of the work is around the ownership for students. So it is a different mindset, as Joe had spoken about earlier. It is very difficult sometimes when students are used to you being at the forefront of their learning. So if they have a question, they're used to you answering it, and it takes some time for them to be able to realize that part of getting ready for college and career is taking ownership of their learning. So part of that leveraging technology and really letting them understand how valuable it is also teaching teachers as well as students how to take ownership of their learning, making decisions around where they are, how to pace that, how to start, you know, developing that voice so that they can speak up for where they need to be. And I think that technology has a great way to allow for us to do that.
Great, thanks a lot. Okay, so this first set of questions is going to be about distance learning in general. And David, I'll just cue, you'll be responding first, but I'll just cue it up a little. So given the richness of online learning technologies available today, we're no longer limited to thinking about distance learning in terms of sort of flat digital representations of textbooks or paper printed materials. And I think that this implies a shift in the way that we can think about leveraging technology for distance. So David, the question is, I'm wondering if you can think about one, maybe briefly share one innovative way that you know of teachers are engaging learners in peer-to-peer learning, something that doesn't happen in a textbook, right, but can happen because we have this rich technology available. Yeah, sorry.
Sure. Well, the part that resonates with me especially is the peer-to-peer learning. And there is actually an organization called Peer-to-Peer University. It's P2PU.org, if you're interested. And I learned about it in December, actually in January of this year, and have gotten very excited about this for our field. It wasn't originally designed to work with adult basic skills, including English for speakers of other languages and including transition to higher education. But they are now quite interested in this. In fact, interested to the extent that they now have a collaboration with World Education working in our field. Let me tell you just a little bit about this model and why I'm excited about it. First of all, I would describe it as a non-formal education model, whereas most of what we offer in our field I would describe as formal, even though it's not school-related, it's out of school. We have a formal system. This model is designed to meet the needs of people in communities and neighborhoods who have something they want to learn. And it's a blended learning model. It involves a free online course that's of interest to them and a face-to-face peer learning model that is led very often by a volunteer and very often in libraries. When I first heard about this, they were finishing up a pilot project in the Chicago Public Library in about 20 branches, in which librarians became facilitators of the peer-to-peer learning groups, the learning circles they're called, and recruited neighborhood people who not only had never taken an online course before, but in many cases didn't even know that there were online courses available, and in some cases didn't necessarily have the online learning skills to benefit from this. So all of these problems that many of you have probably faced in your programs were brought together in this volunteer-led model in which what was really being taught, in addition to some basic computer skills, in addition to learning to learn online skills, in addition to the content of the course, was peer-to-peer learning and how adult learners can help each other to learn these skills. So these are typically 6 to 8 week courses. The model that is being used with World Education is not a transition to higher education model specifically. It's really English language learning for people who are on waiting lists. And in this case, it's not offered in libraries. It's offered in 5 pilot adult basic education programs in New England. They're all English language learning programs, of course.
Yeah, thank you so much. And just parenthetically, we're keeping track of all the URLs that get mentioned here, and we'll send them out. We're going to create a document, so you don't have to worry about jotting everything down if you miss it. So, Chris, I'm wondering, so that's a very creative use of out-of-school technology to support adult learners. I'm wondering if that resonates with you in your work or what else you're doing to support out-of-school learning.
Oh, sure. Actually, yeah, it's funny. My organization is one of the organizations that's piloting the peer-to-peer right now, too, out of in Providence. So I'm not directly involved. But no, but it's interesting because my adult ed organization works out of the public library system in Rhode Island. And public libraries are charged now with promoting digital literacy skills. So we're kind of, you know, under the arm of the library, always encouraging students to take advantage of the resources. And so we're lucky to have... The library has like a really nice, you know, well, libraries now have either labs, but they also have laptop carts or tablet carts that you can use. And we've set up something called the Learning Lounge, where students can come in. It's open to anyone, the general public, but it's also open to our students to come in, where they can come in and start to practice, you know, in a safe space, online learning. So it's self-directed, but we're there as a teacher on site or a trained volunteer to help these people navigate the system, where they're learning English online, helping to trying to get their own make their own resume online. And so we're equipped with the knowledge of the sites where they would need to go to practice these skills. With that in mind, we're able to, you know, to direct them and give them a safe space, and they're able to practice on their own. So, which helps those adult learners that don't have the digital technology at home too. In addition to that, libraries are getting very savvy. Now we can actually lend, and learners can borrow hotspots, so they can, you know, have their own for 3 weeks at a time. They can have their own Wi-Fi at home, too. And we just started lending out devices, which is a little problematic, but so far it's gone pretty well, too. So the only caveat is that learners need a credit card to kind of, you know, balance it in case it walks away. But we haven't lost one yet, knock on wood. But learners can take these out for 3 or 4 weeks at a time and experiment at home with the device, too. So working in a public library system lends itself to that. So I would encourage you to check out local libraries and see what it's a great place to kind of encourage learners to go. And most libraries offer, you know, some kind of introductory classes, too, Microsoft Word, Intro to Computers, that kind of thing, too.
Great. Do any, Joe or Simona, do you have anything to add about supporting out-of-school learning with technology? If you don't, that's fine.
Having a LMS or a BLE, virtual learning environment, or a learning management system is a great way to support distance learning. Incorporating collaboration tools such as discussion boards, Google Docs, also being able to do pre-assessments and mastery checks on your online curriculum within the distance learning, and providing that extra support, whether it be videos, other technology tools, and then, you know, adding activities to your LMS, for instance. Another great way to facilitate the distance learning is through additional support such as Skype, you know, such as FaceTime, and using tools such as Remind, where it's a text service, where you can just text your learners right then and there. And then also social media. What a better way than use Twitter or Facebook? So there's lots of different options out there. We did a one-to-one computer model where we had students borrow computers, and they were able to use them in and outside of the classroom. Those types of things are very important. And we found out that, you know, students do sign a we had them sign a contract saying they wouldn't lose it or they wouldn't damage it. And they really took that and ran with it. We didn't have any, I think we might have had one missing out of about 100 computers. So really giving that, really trusting our learners is key. So there's a lot more things I could talk all day about,
yeah, of course,
but I won't.
And just the one thing I would add to that is just using what students have already. So if they have access to telephones and they use cell phones constantly, being able to use those tools, like you mentioned, Remind is a great one for text messaging students. It's the language that they're able to speak to, so they know how to just get those reminders as well. And then just making sure that they have that access, and using supports like the library also allows for them to be able to recognize that learning can happen anytime. And even for teachers, there's Google Hangouts. There's days where I have been absent from school, but I'm still at home sick, and I'm responding back and forth, whether it's through Hangouts, whether it's through editing their essays using Google. So there's a lot of things that you can do. And once you build that kind of culture in the classroom, students know that you're accessible wherever, and that's the whole mindset of what we want.
Great. Can I add something to that?
Sure.
I wholeheartedly agree with that, and I'm a recent convert to Facebook, not as an avid Facebook personal user, but just to be sure that everybody knows that Facebook has private groups. So you can, if your students are already using Facebook, it's a technology that they're very familiar with, and you can create a private group and invite just them to the group. And it's a fabulous opportunity for engaging in English language learning, conversation, in project-based learning, any number of things, once you know that this is not a public group. The other thing I wanted to mention is using the technology that students have. Students now have cell phones, not necessarily smartphones, but they all have, almost all, have cell phones. And there are some interesting applications for just plain feature phones that have SMS text messaging, one of which is called CellEd, and it's for English language learning in particular. And if that's something you're interested in, I noticed John Engel is here. His program in Texas actually has been doing that. It's used in Texas, California, New York State, and maybe some other places, if that's something you're interested in.
Great, thanks. So I'm keeping a list, too. I know Ebony and Leah are all keeping lists of these resources, so we're catching them. We'll get them to you. I think we have time for one question from the audience before I move on to the next set of questions. Does anybody want to ask any of the panelists a follow-up question?
I'll ask Chris and Joe. You mentioned learning management systems. You used it with Words to Learn. Can you talk a little bit about the value of that? What, you know, especially the difficulty of learning from a distance and keeping folks continuing to do the work.
So we piloted, World Ed and I, we piloted Words to Learn a few years ago. It was a vocabulary app for university students, and it was a way, again, to get students to utilize, it was cell phones, but it didn't have to be a smartphone. They could practice online learning, you know, it's basically vocabulary activities, but they could do it anywhere, too. And the reaction from the students was great, because it was kind of like a breakthrough moment for a lot of them, like, oh, I can study this. I'm waiting in the line at the supermarket, or I'm in the doctor's office, and that learning could take place anywhere, and they kind of got really into it. And so, you know, we practiced a few modules, and a few weeks later, the students like, what, we need another module. What about the next vocabulary lesson? So from a teacher's point of view, it reminded me that you really have to be, you know, on top of this too. Like, once you commit to using this technology and students like it, you kind of have to follow through. And there's some legwork on the part of the teacher to do it, but the value is great. I mean, once you see the students' connection to it, to learning anywhere, and that learning can take place anywhere, it takes off. And it leads to next steps too of what they want to do next.
Yeah, I was focusing mostly on what you said, Joe, about the learning management system, the advantages. And anyone else, raise your hand if you have a question.
Whether it be through Blackboard Learn or Schoology or Canvas or Edmodo, students are able to gain resources from this learning management system. You know, you can align it with what you're doing in the classroom. That's important to actually have it aligned to the CCR standards. You can have videos that come along with it, and you can also have that whole collaboration with your learners, which is important. That engagement, having them on the discussion boards, and posting a question and having them respond to each other, I think students, without even knowing it, are gaining these digital learning these skills, the basic computer skills, by actually going on your LMS and actually evaluating the resources and also utilizing what they have there on the LMS.
Great, thanks. So I'm going to move on to the next set of questions. These are two questions about blended learning. And let's start with Joe. So first, because I really actually believe that the term blended learning is a little slippery. And so I'd like to hear from Joe, because you have such a broad initiative right now in Arizona. How do you define blended learning? And then, understanding that definition, what innovative practice do you see coming out of your new efforts in Arizona?
So it's a huge definition, so bear with me. Hybrid learning, or blended learning, is a formal instructional delivery model that incorporates a distance learning component, where students learn in part through online curricula with some element of student control over time, place, path, or pace. And in the traditional classroom, where students receive direct instruction face-to-face in a brick-and-mortar classroom. A big focus is having students, or having the actual instructor, monitor and support the student progress on the approved online curriculum, in addition to the face-to-face class. And instructors must connect the distance component with the face-to-face instruction with an integrated learning experience. So making sure what you're doing and outside of the classroom connects with what you're doing inside the classroom. So making sure that aligns and connects, okay? So in Arizona, we have quite a few things going on. So let me start with introducing the state to hybrid learning. And that happened in FY14, where we rolled out online curricula to the whole state. So that meant training over 500 instructors, doing face-to-face training as well as webinar technical assistance, and then having the actual instructors roll that out to the students. We have 13,000 students. So actually starting from that phase. And then also from there, teaching the instructors how to use learning management systems to support hybrid learning. So providing them with a list of resources, different learning management systems, virtual learning environments that they can use to support that. And then from there, teaching the instructors how to align their curriculum through CCR standards. So align their online curricula and everything that they're doing within the classroom, making sure that face-to-face and that and the online curricula really work together. So that's going to take some planning time. We had to, you know, and programs have to give their teachers that planning time in order to make hybrid learning work.
Great. Thanks. So mm-hmm. I noticed the definition that you gave came from the Clayton Christensen
yes.
Institute. And that's another URL that I hope you guys will all check out. If you just do a web search on online learning blended learning modules, you'll come up with the Clayton Christensen Institute. And the reason I mention it is I think it's important for everyone to know that through this implementation process in Arizona, those models are giving teachers some structure around how to think about balancing what happens in and out of the classroom. Mm-hmm. So they're not just doing it on their own. There is actually something to read about and react to when they think about their own practice.
Yeah. So I mean, we really had to start with the online curriculum first and really introduce them to that first. And now we're really diving into the hybrid learning models. That's like second or third phase. So there's a continuum.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't happen at once for sure.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. So, Simona, one of the things that I think is most exciting about your work is your attention to the learner and learner agency and cultural knowledge and empowerment. So how do you see blended learning programs or blended learning as being a tool to empower your adult learners? And then specifically then, how does differentiated instruction play into that?
I think just the concept as described of blended learning in itself allows for students to realize that learning doesn't just happen in four walls. And the concept of any time, any place really allows for students to realize that as well as for teachers. So in a sense, students become the pilots and they're the ones that are in charge of their learning. And I think just as a classroom teacher experiencing students be able to realize that the curriculum is there for them and that they can access it how they want kind of takes away that teacher as the main one in control. And I think it takes a lot, especially as educators. We want to make sure that we know how the classroom's running, where every student is, and it's a control thing sometimes. And when you learn to let go and you're just transparent with the curriculum that's there, and it does take a lot of prep work, I think that's also sometimes a misconception with blended learning, understanding that face-to-face model and that there's tools that will empower learners also requires teachers to understand that there's a lot of prep work that goes into building that. So when you do build that curriculum where everything is out there, it's transparent, it aligns to the Common Core standards as you mentioned, then you can kind of breathe as a teacher a little bit and let the students have autonomy in where they want to go. And I think part of the empowerment piece comes where teachers have to be aware and transparent. They have to know what the standards are, but most importantly, they need to make sure they're giving the students the opportunity to see where they began, so those pre-assessments are important, and then having that ending place for them. And when students can take control over that, I think the empowerment begins. Another piece of it is really thinking how you can engage learners so that it's not just that classroom experience. I had a chance to pilot the Expanded Learning Opportunity Program. So I know here in Rhode Island, we do a lot of ELOs, and that is also the concept of really giving the curriculum to students and giving that experience so that they have a chance to think about where they want to go, whether it's college or career, and having them work with a mentor. So part of that curriculum aligned to the English ELA standards, but it also allowed for students to get that work experience. So we had mentors that came either into the classroom or they allowed for them to work outside of the classroom with students. And then part of my work as a teacher was making sure that the research was there, the reflection, and all of the work that the students had to demonstrate was aligned to the English standards, so that way they can get a mix of that experience. So making sure that those things are in place really helps for students to have ownership.
Great, thanks. So if you're sitting here wondering, what does that really look like in a classroom? I'd encourage you to check out the book that David authored, Blended Learning for the Adult Education Classroom, which is structured around vignettes that provide really excellent illustration. David, would you like to comment any further on the book and how you set it up and what's in there for people?
Thank you. Sure. I think it's important, if we're talking about blended learning, to get really grounded in what it looks like. And so I contacted my colleagues around the country asking for examples of teachers and tutors, I might add, who they thought were doing an interesting job in developing blended learning models. This was I did the research about 3 years ago. Things have changed and grown enormously since then. It's almost time to update this. But there are vignettes of what's going on, and quite a range, and there's a good chance that you'll find at least a couple that will be inspiring to you. One of the things that I became aware of in doing the research is that there were programs that had not been doing anything at all with blended learning, and in some cases not with distance learning or even online learning. There are programs that were doing distance learning, that were doing online learning, but not really blending it in the way that Joe mentioned, the integration, which is really very important. I mean, the power of this model, I think, is that what happens online and what happens face-to-face are brought together to strengthen and reinforce each other. That's where you get the more time on task that we've been so lacking in our field. If we offer 3 to 6 hours of face-to-face a week, it's really hard to get the intensity that students with these new higher CCR standards that Joe has mentioned several times, how are they going to reach those higher standards without putting in more time on task? So it's the combination of online and face-to-face, but really the integrated model that gives them the power. And so you'll see some examples of that. So what I was trying to do with this guide is to help programs think through wherever they were in the process, either not doing it at all yet or actually doing a fairly sophisticated job but wanting to improve what they were doing. And so I developed a series of tools for programs to use to think through where they were, where they wanted to go, and how to make some decisions about this. And I might add that a very important decision, and sometimes a difficult one, is the one Joe was mentioning before, which is what is going to be our learning management system? And how is that going to fit with, for example, our existing face-to-face curriculum that we very much like? Or, alternatively, how is that going to help us develop a new curriculum or find a better curriculum than we're currently using, which happens to be an online curriculum? All of these kinds of decisions have to be worked through and sorted out, and not just by the administrator of the program. It has to be a collegial process where teachers are involved in that decision.
Yeah, thank you. So I'd like to hear if any what you guys are thinking or any questions you might have about anything about blended learning or specifically what you've heard so far.
Feel free to raise your hand and I'll come over to you.
Don't be shy.
Yeah, Liz.
Just in response to what you were saying, Joe, and the multi-year PD commitment, I just think it's really easy to cut that short and do a little thing about a really cool tool and an intention for something much better, but no time and no PD to really implement things the way all of you are talking about. I'm wondering if that's common in other places. I've definitely saw it in Minnesota, even though we've got good practice, but really common, here's this learner web thing online, I'm just gonna have the students crank through that app. I think very little integration with what was happening in the classroom and calling that hybrid.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, I wasn't doing it myself, but from the periphery it looked like that was probably a common phase at least, and it could be that it's developed since then. Maybe just a comment, I don't know if there's any question.
I can speak a little bit just because that definitely, if it's with the PD, it has to definitely be something that's ongoing. So I had a chance, and I don't know, Highlander Institute is a really great opportunity as well. So I had a chance to work with the FUSE program, and their whole model is allowing teachers to go to different school districts to make sure that it's embedded in their PD and it's part of their vision and strategic plan. So what that work means is ongoing. There's coaching that happens for the teachers, and it is, like you said, it's very easy sometimes for you to learn a cool tool and then feel that you've mastered it and then something new comes on and then it can be very overwhelming. So it's really important to identify with that PD for different districts who the early adopters are in the school and figuring out where they stand and then trying to develop that. And once you have those teachers that are really engaged and really excited about it and they're willing to take risks because it can be messy and understanding that they're going through that process, then those early adopters are the ones that help to bring the life to the school. And then other teachers can see that, and then that becomes almost a model of sustainability. So it is really important for districts and teachers to really kind of build their own PLC to make it grow and work well.
Great, thank you. Any other questions? Thanks.
I was just curious about some, maybe other, a couple of other best practice type examples, and I'm specifically curious about where is this learning occurring and what are the size of the cohorts? Is it all going on at adult ed centers, or is it one-stops, or is it employers, and what are the learnings in terms of this, you know, cohort size and that sort of thing for best practice?
So in Arizona, it's all going on at the program level. So our programs, we have different types of organizations. We have community colleges, we have nonprofits. So it's a mixed bag of different organizations. For example, we have a technology integration initiative where we have educational technology facilitators. And those are, we have educational technology facilitators at each program. So we have 24 programs. So each program has at least one or two ed tech facilitators, which train instructors on how to use technology in the classroom. So those educational technology facilitators are responsible for going in the classroom and observing, as well as passing on tools. So what we do at the state office is have webinars. So in those webinars, we touch on those technology tools, and those webinars are recorded. So programs can go to our livebinders.com, which is a resource. They can go on and click on a webinar and listen to it 24/7. So things like that, simple recordings, and also having a point person, such as an educational technology facilitator, there to support your learners. We have DL. We have DL instructors that are responsible for DL. We have your instructional leaders that are supposed to be out there also supporting their instructors. So those contexts, those roles are specifically for that support of those instructors.
Great, thank you. So I'd like to move on to the next set of questions, and we're going to talk about mobile learning next. So Chris, I'd like you to start us off with this. Using personal devices or loaned tablets, you kind of talked about this a little bit already, an adequate strategy to address learner access issues? So what works? How does it still yet fall short? And what would you recommend?
Yeah, oh, tough question. I can say on the negative side, Rhode Island, I think we're last in the country in terms of population that has access to high-speed internet. So the gap is a huge gap that I think in adult ed we could never totally address. But I guess we can address the learners that come in our door. And I think that's where mobile learning can take, you know, get students activated and taking the first steps to get to show, have learners show success and just to inspire them at what they can do in mobile learning. It opens up a whole new world. But I think also, again, it goes back to, you know, being open to different kinds of approaches, not just the classroom, but again, like kind of like learning places where learners can go and you can help them and encourage them, because they need practice time on whatever you're going to have them do online. They need a lot of practice time and they need a lot of handholding to get through what they need to before you can really let them go off and do blended and distance learning on their own. But from our strategies that we've done, the learning lounges, introducing mobile technology in the classroom, I think you can definitely, we've seen a lot of signs of success. And when I think of learners, I think of learners who came in with no digital literacy skills, older learners, learners who have displaced workers who have lost their job and who don't know how to apply for jobs online. You can have success with any learner. It just takes a lot of time, so don't get discouraged.
So, Chris, do you think that the tablet program without the hotspot would work, or do they need to go together?
It can work, yeah. If you can encourage them, like, once you get them on board with what Wi-Fi is, if they can find a place that has Wi-Fi, yeah. Dunkin' Donuts or in Rhode Island. The libraries or any place that has Wi-Fi, they can use it. When they realize that, then they can go anywhere they want to, yeah.
Great, thanks. Definitely. So now I'd like to also think, you know, we can have these devices available to solve access problems outside of school, but then also there's the potential for bringing those devices into class and having learners use their own personal devices within classroom learning. Simona, what experience do you have with that, and what have been some of the challenges and the things that have really worked?
I definitely have mixed feelings about it, to be honest. It's just like with anything as a teacher that you would introduce in the classroom. If the expectations aren't clear and you haven't built the culture, then you're going to have problems with whatever technology they bring in. So I've seen and had experience issues where, you know, students may be text messaging to each other and you're not aware of it. So they're smart, they're tech savvy, and they know how to get around these things. And it's very important, just like you would do in the beginning of the year, establishing those rules. If you're trying to build a culture around blended learning, then the students have to be just aware of what the expectations are, and they need to also understand as well what it means to be in a blended environment. So in using it in the classroom, we're lucky now to have a one-to-one ratio where we have the computers accessible for students, but in places where you don't, I would definitely make sure those rules are clear and also have consequences, and just do like a guided, doesn't matter the age, but the guided instruction is really important. So here's how we use technology. Now would be a really good chance for you to use your computer or your phone for researching. So you have to really hand walk students through the process and also be very firm with consequences, otherwise it will be abused. And once it's abused, then the whole model and the pedagogy of trying to build this environment can be ruined. So you definitely have to be clear around the expectations.
Great. Anything else anybody on the panel wants to add about in-class use of devices and apps? I'm thinking too, I'm trying to imagine what it's like to get 24 people into one app on different devices. I'm sure you've lived through that. What was it like, and how did you get there?
You could get there. It's the challenge would be, well, it's like today in the Edmodo session. I mean, you can get, people get on really quickly, some people won't. And so the challenge as a teacher or, you know, any kind of facilitated learning environment is students are going to be at different levels at the same time. So you're kind of, you know, you're as teacher as kind of monitor and kind of encouraging them where to go next. I think that's the model you guys bring up, though, is really important, where if you're letting go of the learning and you're kind of letting them go, and like that's then you can see that progress goes. As a teacher, you have to let go because you can't manage 24 different people at different stages on an app at the same time. They have to, if you have the clear learning goals of what it is they're supposed to be doing, and let them go crazy, and you're kind of monitoring them. And so, yeah, you kind of go with it.
And one just quick thing to add, I think part of the blended learning model in itself is about like the station rotation and using it very wisely. So if you have flex model or station rotation, then you're, as a teacher, kind of taking that ownership and that control back, because you know only a limited amount of students may be using the technology at once while you might be doing that direct instruction face-to-face. So it's important that you think about those models and not try something where everyone's going to use it at once, being proactive and knowing that the internet may be an issue, and really using blended learning to the way it's supposed to, with the face-to-face as well.
So just by way of definition, flex model, station rotation, these are all different models that Clayton Christensen has defined for blended learning. So check them out. It's a really interesting way to structure work. And Joe, I think that you had something to add.
All right. I'll go ahead. So the station rotation is a really important model, especially for our learners, because you can have your learners doing a face-to-face environment. You can have your instruction there. You can have an activity or some project-based learning, and then you can have some online curriculum work going on at the same time, and they're switching different stations. So that's a way to really break it up, break those levels up, and it takes it off of the actual instructors as well. So, and there's lots of, you know, different models out there, but you have to see what works best for your learners, and looking at the data will help you decide which model is best for you.
Can you say more about how you've used data in Arizona to make those kinds of decisions?
Yeah, so with our online curriculum, we have a pre-assessment. We also have mastery checks, so we can use those mastery checks and see what students are struggling on, and you can connect that back to, you know, helping your students with that problem area and the face-to-face instruction and that face-to-face classroom environment. So steadily be doing those checks with the data to help your students to make sure they're understanding the content. And that's how we align the face-to-face with the online curricular or outside the classroom. That connection is important. Without that connection, it's not hybrid learning. It's not blended learning.
Yeah, great, thanks. So I'm aware we haven't had a chance for questions about mobile learning or using mobile devices in or out of the classroom. Is there anything you're thinking about or anything you're pondering that you'd like to share?
You guys are so quiet.
Who's doing mobile learning? How so? Okay, on their devices, on their phones?
Or tablet, they bring their tablet. And pretty much using it as a discussion forum for the class to talk about things that we're doing in class, problem-based learning, giving them a problem as a group outside and having them solve things.
And what state are you from?
Arizona.
Okay, just checking.
That's it. Anyone not from Arizona doing mobile devices in their classrooms? In or out, yeah. What are you doing with them?
We're using Kahoot as a craft.
Yeah.
Our instructors use Kahoot as a way of breaking up, getting along, and letting students interact and
Anything else? Yes.
I have a question, you know, in regards to access. You know, we have people in rural areas don't have broadband, we don't even have cell phones in some places, and I'm trying to encourage them. I'd like to hear the peer-to-peer learning. I wonder, since you mentioned it about Dunkin' Donuts, somebody like Dunkin' Donuts or McDonald's would help sponsor a hotspot for specifically online learning, as opposed to just for teenagers to get on Facebook, but as, you know, help promote it, maybe help sponsor it. It would be a win-win, I think, for them as well. I don't know if anybody knows of anything like that.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, actually, McDonald's, since you mentioned it, has gotten very interested in providing adult basic skills now for all of their employees. They have a free online high school diploma program for any McDonald's employee. They have for several years had a program for training line workers to become managers, actually shift managers, which is the first step. And in particular for people who had learned English as a second or other language. And they provide all of that training to their employees on work, paid work time. So I've actually raised with them the question of extending that to the community. And the answer to that question, at least for now, is that's up to the individual restaurants. So if in your city or your town or neighborhood or rural area, there is a McDonald's and they do know about the opportunities that are available to McDonald's employees, or if they don't, tell them. but then raise the question and say, would you be willing, for example, to either create a separate hotspot or would you perhaps let people use your own hotspot? Probably the answer is no to the second. So I wanted to mention, and many of you know about this, but in case you don't, there is a program called Everyone On. It's a program that has a lot of partners at the federal level, one of which is the U.S. Department of Education. And if you go to everyoneon.org/adulted, that's very important. I'll tell you why in a minute. You can actually purchase a hotspot for, I think, about $60. And you can get, as an adult ed teacher or as any adult ed student, regardless of income, you can get access to broadband, not necessarily top of the line, but broadband access for roughly $10 to $12 a month. And you can also purchase desktop and laptop computers. It varies from state to state what's available, but at pretty deep discounts. So, for example, what some programs in rural areas have done is to essentially buy a hotspot and a $10 a month access and create access in the classroom. Even programs that have access, but not in the classroom, it's in the learning lab, for example. Sometimes teachers do that so that they can also provide access in the classroom. So maybe some of those would help you.
I would also say with mobile learning to begin to look toward learning management systems that download content so that folks don't need to have access. You know, some of the things that Chris and I worked on earlier, there are platforms, and now Moodle and others will do the same thing, where if you get an app on the phone, Canvas I think is another one, I think maybe even Schoology is doing it too, the learner can be in the classroom, download the content, often it can be even the video or the text and all on their phone, and then take it wherever they would go and not have to have access to their data plan or even Wi-Fi. Mm-hmm. So they could download their lessons in class with you and take them home, even if they didn't have access.
Yeah, Carissa has a question or a comment.
Hi, I just wanted to point out that if you've not heard of the National Digital Inclusion Alliance, NDIA, I've really been following them because they have started to be leaders in stepping out to say that Wi-Fi internet access is basic human right, and I really believe in that. And so two things I wanted to say about access are, one, I had always this dream. We have libraries where cars park outside the library to get the little sliver of Wi-Fi that they can get. And wouldn't that be, you know, there are some examples of cities that have some blocks that are have that internet for free. But my understanding is now that there's some outside technology that the price is going down in that can expand that Wi-Fi access out blocks and blocks. So I think maybe when we're sitting here next year, this could look different. And then the second thing, going back to the public libraries, is I would say definitely be putting the pressure on your local library to be loaning of Wi-Fi hotspots. That's a service that they should be providing to the community, and I think would be receptive if you would go to them and tell them, if it's just even just for the adult ed population, they would be receptive to that.
Great, thanks. And Carissa, that actually makes me think that maybe with WIOA and collaboration amongst agencies and workforce development, that this is a conversation for the WIBs too, and a way to support collaboration. So when I think about businesses, maybe McDonald's or Dunkin' Donuts offering hotspots, maybe that's a way to support the collaboration.
And I would just add to that, just in, as part of teaching students, again, how to access learning on their own and to have them be in charge of that, really creating environments where it's a field trip and you're showing them all of these resources in their community that allow for them to log on and do that for free. Maybe they'll buy French fries and they can sit there for a couple of hours and get access to the computer. But really, again, bringing it back to, you want your students to be advocates and them to know what those resources are. So making it an experience, a field trip or something where you can explore.
That's great, thanks. Okay, so the last couple questions, we're going to circle back to PD. And David, I think we'll let you respond to this one. So you're deeply involved in the professional development of many ABE teachers across the country. And I wonder what you have recognized as systems of best practices and how they're implemented and shared. So what systems are required to disseminate the best practices that you've seen? And you can stretch out of blended and distance a little bit if you think there's something you've observed in the past that would really work well here, or just comment on sharing practice around distance and blended.
Well, I can talk a little bit about what does exist. There isn't a ton of stuff. You're not going to have to be bewildered by all of the resources that are available to you for professional development, but in the way you would if you worked in K through 12, or to some extent in higher ed. But there is, and many of you probably know about this, but for those of you who may not, there is a national system of professional development called LINCS. How many of you are familiar with LINCS? Ah, okay, good. So most of you are, L-I-N-C-S, by the way. And so you know that LINCS has 16 different communities of practice, they're called, two of which I moderate, the technology and learning and the program management. But there are several that might be of interest to you. I think, for example, of preparing people for post-secondary education. That would be of interest, I think, and career pathways, and perhaps others like disabilities and assessment. There is a pretty wide range of groups of people who are focused on particular areas. And you can get that delivered to your email. It could be immediately, or it could be by digest once a day. There are also a number of documents. Some of them are studies or the result of research. Some of them are curricula. Some of them are other documents, advocacy pieces, and to some extent, theoretical pieces. All of these have been reviewed by professional people in our field, and they're made available to you for free. And there is a robust search engine on LINCS so that you can find these. There are also some free online courses, and many people have said these courses are quite good, and particularly, I think, for beginning teachers, or teachers new to our field at least, but not only those. One of which, by the way, if there are people who are teaching English for teaching English as a second or other language, there is a very exciting new course that was just launched this year. It's called ESL Pro, that I've had a chance to take a look at and think is quite impressive. There are many good courses, though, and including in technology, there's a long-standing course that many people have taken in integrating technology that I would recommend to you. Oh, and one other thing, if any of you happen to work with learners at a very basic literacy level, there is a not too well-known Lynx website that has a program called Tutor Ready, and it is a just-in-time professional development program for reading tutors or literacy tutors that is quite good. So in addition to Lynx, you should certainly know about World Education courses, and also COABE, the Commission on Adult Basic Education, in case you didn't know the full name of COABE, is now doing a lot of work in professional development online as well as face-to-face. They launched, for example, this year for the first time an online two-day conference that went on the whole pretty well. So in addition to that, there are lots of things that are harder to find out about it. You probably know about the professional development already available in your state. If you don't, that would be a good thing to find out about. It varies from state to state. Some states do a really good job with this. I think, for example, Minnesota and several other states and several places within states. If you happen to be in New York City, you're in great shape with the Literacy Assistance Center. So that's certainly something that I would recommend that you look into. But then there are some things, there are people who on their own moderate discussion lists. I'm one of them, there are others. I moderate a group for adult education teachers who are interested in learning how to use Facebook private groups. And it's not incidentally because I'm an expert in this, I moderate the group, the expertise is within the group. And I consider myself a learner in a model that I now refer to as WALT. We are all learning this together. But it's fun. I also moderate an M-learning group, a mobile learning group, and I have started co-moderating a group on competency-based or proficiency-based adult education. With Donna Chambers, who will be here tomorrow. She and I and another colleague are doing a session on competency-based education. But there's an online group that a lot of people have joined because they're interested in learning about it or because they're interested in helping others to learn about it.
So it's interesting to me that most of the PD opportunities you described resonate with the tension, I think, that Liz suggested earlier, and that is the limitations of a sort of one-shot, this is what could be helpful for you workshop, rather ongoing support. And then Jill Hathaway was talking about earlier about how in Rhode Island that there's then scaffolded support often that really helps teachers integrate some of this new learning stuff. So Joe, makes me think of the work that you're doing in Arizona with this hybrid initiative, and I wonder if you could just briefly characterize your approach to providing sustained distance learning to a number of teachers in your state.
Sure.
Or sorry, sustained professional development. You knew what I meant.
Sure, we have a state leadership calendar, so that's where we have our state leadership initiatives booked on that calendar, so any of our programs, teachers, administrators can go to that calendar. It's a Google calendar, and they can see what events are coming up. We also have an event management system where the programs can sign up or register for an event. We have a content management system where we're adding resources to, so programs can go on the content management system and gain more resources. We have a live binder, so that's another content management system where we store webinars. We record webinars, we store webinars in there. We have a live binder for administrators and a live binder for instructors, and that really helps them where they don't have to come to us all the time. They can go to that live binder and check out a recorded webinar, pre-recorded webinar, and gain information from that, or they can go there and get a link to a video. So we tried to have resources in different places. As far as professional learning or professional development, when it comes to ed tech initiatives, we have an initiative called Diverse Learning Models, where we're training programs on how to use the online curriculum and the best practices and strategies for that. We have the Tech Integration Initiative, what I was talking about, the tech integration specialists or the facilitators, and it's a train-a-trainer model. So we do webinars with these educational technology facilitators, and they train, and then they go and train their instructors on how to use the technology tools in the classroom. We also have instructional design and planning. So helping instructors pick the hybrid learning model that's best for them, and also helping them connect and align their resources or their curriculum with the CCR standards, which is important. And all of these initiatives have a face-to-face component, an online course component, and a webinar component. So it's us modeling hybrid learning. And then last but not least, we have IDEAL 101 and 102. So if you want to learn more about IDEAL 101, 102, Jen is doing a great webinar, or not, a great face-to-face session tomorrow. So that's my plug. I'm not going to tell too much about it, but it's to help programs understand hybrid learning and help them to develop a hybrid learning site plan. And then they can actually pilot hybrid learning, blended learning at their program. Yeah. That's 101. 102 is more of a case study where they come together and as a group that comes together and solves that case. And then they pilot from that case study. So there's a lot going on, lots of things that I'm excited about, lots of different pockets that are doing some great work within Arizona.
Yeah, it sounds like a multi-pronged approach.
It is. I don't sleep. Bev doesn't sleep. She's over professional learning, so she doesn't sleep either.
Great. So we have about 10 minutes left, and I would love to hear some more questions from you in the audience, either on professional development issues or if there's anything else that you have been thinking about asking. Now is your time.
We give you guys 10 minutes for questions, and no one's answering them.
Can you just say a little bit about the 101 and 102? Is that pretty much,
So the ideal 101 and 102, is that pretty much presentation, conveying concepts and models and that kind of thing, or is it active, engaged learning?
It's a multimodal professional development opportunity that stretches across several months. And within each phase, there's a different focus to the learning. So it starts off ideally with a webinar or a face-to-face kickoff where there's an overview of the course and a description of all of the materials that'll be used. There's a book. The book is actually on the IDEAL website. If you go to ideal.worlded.org, you'll find the handbook. It's the IDEAL handbook. Our IDEAL Distance Education and Blended Learning Handbook. We decided to share that with everyone so that you get a sense of the expertise that we're supporting and that we're asserting, and hope that you might start to integrate it into your own programming. Then along with that, there's online discussion around the chapters of the module, followed by team-based activity development. So at the end of the sequence of reading, discussing, and doing an activity, you, meaning you and whoever works with you at your site, will have an implementable that's a word, implementable distance learning or hybrid learning plan that over the next couple months you'll pilot with the support of discussion and webinars. So it is not just, here's a Moodle, you can use it. It's, wow, if you have a Moodle, let's think about how you're going to design a program around recruitment, screening, orientation, instruction, and assessment. It's all the components that are required for successful.
So yeah, you really take a look at the program operations piece.
And I'll make a pitch now that Jen and Ben Bruno have been working on. We will have, by January, introduction to blended learning. So much of what we're talking about today will be part of that. The models, you can learn that. It's a self-paced course. And also mobile learning will be in January as well. So
I would love to hear more questions from you guys. What are you thinking? Who heard something new today that they're going to take back with them? Oh, come on. Yes, can you share with us what you're thinking?
Well, I have Moodle in my classroom. I think what I have taken away today is to have steps in my development of the courses, like you have pre-assessment and we have an assessment system, which we do face-to-face, sort of. But it's missing some components, and so I appreciate the conversation today.
Great. And I have a question. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I just had a question in regards to online learning in that sense of the fear that sometimes people have of it. And I'm new to this, to adult ed world, but in high schools, they talk about it, but then they don't let students access Facebook, don't bring your cell phones to school with you, and all the things that are counter to kind of opening up to that world. And I'm wondering in this type of push to get more of this, is there a fear out there? I think my mother was going to report me for stealing internet from the neighbors on wireless or something, because they don't understand how it all works.
Well, how about Joe Chris or Simona, what do you guys think as the practitioners in the classroom?
No, that's a good point. Recently this year, I've been experimenting a lot with YouTube. And as an instructor, YouTube, you're one step away from putting something out, you know, to the whole world to see, too. So I was wondering how students would be involved with that. And you have a lot of, if you're going to use kind of technology that has that kind of opening, you really have to be careful and reassert every time. Like, you know, when you have a video ready, here's the settings, what's the setting on? And you really have to kind of walk them through it. And they knew I was, I was more scared than they were. They were like, oh, whatever, I don't care who sees it. But no, really, check the privacy settings. Because you have unlisted versus public on YouTube. But I think the best thing is starting with baby steps. I just had my class download the YouTube app, and I gave them some links of videos to watch and just see how they do with that. And then you can kind of make it to the next step where maybe a teacher created a video to show them. And then, you know, steps on modeling, you know, PowerPoint presentation on how do you, for example, be how do you, you know, make a video, for example, using your phone and that. And then how do you share the phone? I could break it up into digestible chunks and steps like you would an ESL lesson. And I think then you can kind of move them from step to step and in a safe environment too. Yeah, the mistake would be just to like just do the whole lesson. Oh, let's make a video and share it. Then, you know, then bad things would happen. So incremental learning, I guess, would be the best. I think the best approach for that. Yeah, it's a valid point though. Valid concern.
Yeah, Facebook and YouTube are very good examples because those are two things that are commonly blocked. Yeah. When I was teaching in St. Paul, that was the case, and we were trying to put together responsive online learning for our students, and we couldn't use YouTube. So it was a big challenge. So I think there's maybe an unacknowledged or an undiscussed aspect to this too, and that's policy. The policy and the implications on learners. And sometimes I think policy lags behind the innovation that teachers can bring to a classroom. So perhaps being an advocate for innovation, pushing up as well as bringing learners in is an important part of the work.
I have a couple of comments about that. One is, one of the reasons that sometimes teachers get hotspots and set up their own access to the internet within their classroom is so they can access YouTube videos because their school system or their university or college doesn't allow them to do that. But the other thing I wanted to say is where I see the most fear is not from learners, it's from teachers. And it, part of it is the that our teaching paradigm is, as teachers, we are experts, and our learners are to learn from us. And that paradigm has to shift. And we have to help teachers to learn how to make that shift and take those risks. The model that I mentioned before, the Walt model, we're all learning this together. And teachers can do that if they say to their students, look, I'm an expert in teaching you English, or I'm an expert in preparing you for science in post-secondary education, but I'm not an expert in technology, and together we're going to have to solve these technology problems. And by the way, that is the model that we use in business and in the rest of our lives. We help each other. It's peer-to-peer learning. So we better start doing it in the classroom.
Great. Any more questions from you, our participants? So what I've heard over the last 90 minutes is that and for us to really succeed with this work, we need to create comfortable environments, both in classrooms and in online spaces, that from our panelists, these are our panelists' words as I'm synthesizing them, support learner engagement and learner agency, and also help learners leverage the assets they already bring to the classroom. And that we can only do this with sustained, adequate, and well-supported professional development for the teachers and some push up to policymakers to make all of this a reality. And I think I will leave it at that. We're at 6 o'clock. And I'm just really grateful for your presence and for your questions and for your expertise. And it's been a great conversation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jen. Thank you, Simone, David, Chris, Joe. Thank you very much.